Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome back to ESPN Scrum Reset for another week. It's Sam Bruce, joined as per usual by Christy Doran. And Christy, that was a pretty bloody good round of Super Rugby Pacific, mainly because it was unpredictable.
Yeah, it was a great tweet fired off by Paul Cully at the end of Saturday night when the Reds upset the Chiefs by saying the real talking point here is that the biggest margin throughout the weekend, across the weekend, was 10 points. And you've nailed it. It was a fantastic weekend of rugby. There was jeopardy on the line and a bit of excitement. That kind of flame has just returned back to Super Rugby at long last, which is awesome.
Yeah, I actually had a couple of mates talk to me over the weekend saying that they're actually really enjoying Super Rugby Pacific this year. I don't know if you've experienced the same. Blokes that have kind of drifted away from the game certainly watch far more league than they do rugby these days, but I think the positive early signs are there that we agree it's not being over-refereed. Two, the games have been pretty close, as we say. There's only been a few blowouts so far, and we think back to last round, there was only one and that was the one we probably didn't see coming, was the Chiefs building the Brumbies. So, I mean, positive early signs. I spoke with Kevin Malloy, the Super Rugby Pacific chairman, last week. He was wrapped with how things were travelling at this early point in the season. So hopefully that positivity continues. And one place where there is a load of positivity is Queensland, is Ballymore. Probably one of the best wins, I would think, since their title of 2011, Christy. Built on a rock-solid defence. Kind of all the traits that we thought Brad Thorne had instilled in them, this real fight and want to get on the ball, the breakdown. But then with that little bit of extra class around the paddock, this team knows how they want to play the game. They're well and truly working hard for each other. And you know, right, they were talking in the preseason, this is a new era for Queensland, and it's looking like it might well just be that.
Yeah, it's in the top five victories of the last probably decade, you'd have to say, since the championship of 2011. There were some uncanny characteristics and similarities with last year's win over the Chiefs with Queensland managing to defend their line. It was, I think, 20 plus 20 phases once again. Yep. New Plymouth. And to once again hold him out for 23 phases, 3 minutes. It was the length of the field. You thought that they might score it in that one sweeping movement down the right-hand touchline. But amazing defence and resilience, the ability not to give a penalty away, because that would have allowed the Chiefs just to be able to go for broke, knowing that they've got an insurance with the penalty there. Outstanding win, and you're right, they've just put on a couple of layers since Brad Thorne. Like, there was always fight grit underneath a Brad Thorne coach side, but now you're getting structure, you're getting black players that may have plateaued that are now starting to find their feet. And I think of Harry Wilson, like the things that he's doing and he's probably being allowed to do, it's just, in Les Kiss's words, pull the trigger. And I think it's just playing to his strengths. He's a baller, and we're seeing, you know, the balls between his legs. You're seeing the pops over the top, the little kicks in behind. They're a side that's playing with a fair bit of confidence, and it's built around a strong coaching team with Zane Hilton there with the forward pack. Been really impressed with what they're doing. And even the guys that are coming in, like Isaac Henry's seamless transition to coming in for a Hunter Paisami, who was out with concussion. And Henry has had a few injuries himself over the last couple of years. Magnificent performance, and there's real balance throughout that side. And if you're Joe Schmidt, Brucey, I reckon you're rubbing your hands together going, you know what? The Wallabies, what they showed last year, isn't actually a proper kind of
reflection
of where they're at the moment, I'd say.
Yeah, I'd agree wholeheartedly, mate. A beautiful little try they worked down the short side there with Harry Wilson, Suliasi Vinavalu, and then back on the inside there to McRyden. And don't those two just love playing off each other? You know, it's almost like they're tied together by a length of baling twine or something, a bit of rope that, you know, where one goes, you're sure to find the other. And they work so well as a combo, don't they? And then Liam Wright, who's just doing the tough stuff, isn't he? And he's a player, again, we spoke about guys we think might be kind of Joe Schmidt types of players. You do wonder whether Liam Wright, if he can stay injury free, and I think, you know, that's the main thing for him, isn't it? He has had such a checkered run with his body over the past probably 5 or 6 years, even his entire career at Queensland, and just hasn't been had that little bit of luck to string games together a full season. Touch wood that continues for him this year, because he's not a flashy player, but he just does the honest, tough stuff, and that's something that can be in short supply, has been in short supply in Australian rugby, you'd have to say.
Yeah, and I think it was about 17 tackles. He's very handy at the line out, and he's just a player that rarely puts a foot wrong. He's also a player that, and the reason why I think he's fallen out of that Wallabies reckoning over the last year or two, in addition to the injuries, is he a six? Is he a seven? And he's almost that in-between guy, like Chris Robshaw was a few years back. And you go, what's his real strengths here? And could he even find himself back in a seven position? I wouldn't necessarily rule it out from a test perspective. But who do you think's more likely to play for the Wallabies, Harry Wilson or Liam Wright under Joe Schmidt? Because both of them have got claims. You imagine Fraser McBride's going to be right there, but there's a great balance. And as you said, that partnership of knowing where players are going to be and bouncing off each other, you see it in spades with McBride and Wilson. I wouldn't be surprised if you see, and it's obviously no massive revelation this, but I can see Wilson very much coming back into flavour now, a couple of years further down the line, and with what he's producing, the quality he's producing, it's a level above what we've seen in the last 2 to 3 years.
It's a great question, mate, because when you think about Rob Valentini, the reigning Johnny Eels medalist, has kind of had a mortgage on that number eight jersey, first under Dave Rennie, and then clearly Eddie Jones as well last year. And probably been a little bit slow out of the gates this year, Rob. A bit like the Brumbies themselves, you'd have to say, on the evidence of the last couple of weeks. Anyway, was better against the Force on Saturday, and we'll come to that shortly. But yeah, Harry's, I mean, we've spoken about him almost, it feels like, every week on this pod the last 3 or 4 years, hasn't he? And nobody doubts that he's a player of immense talent, can do things other back rowers probably can't. We think about that he's got beautiful soft hands. The way he pops up, seems to pop up in, you know, try-scoring opportunities more than any other back rower in the game in support or, you know, running those key support lines. So, look, is there a spot for him, you know, maybe on the bench? I wouldn't mind betting that Joe might trial a few different combinations against Wales and then Georgia clearly as well. So it would be a big surprise, I would say, to have, you know, Rob Valentini play all those three games at number eight potentially. So look for a bit of, you know, not experimentation is probably the wrong word, but some trialing of some different combinations. And perhaps that's when we'll see Harry and Fraser together in a 7 and 8 at test level. Obviously, a long way to go in this season. For Liam Wright, look, I think he's just got to keep turning up as he has the first 3 weeks and put his name in that six conversation along with, you know, your Tom Hoopers, your Jed Holloways. Who else am I missing there?
You're Rob Leotis.
Rob Leotis, thank you. Yeah, who picked up an injury on Friday, didn't he? I don't know how serious that was, but a long may it continue.
I can see Valentini potentially at a six and Harry Wilson at eight. I just think the two of them, great ball running options. And when you have a second row, which I'm not sure if Will Skelton's going to come back for those July tests and whether or not he even features throughout a rugby championship, there's probably not enough muscle in the second row in Australia, right across the board, with an Isaac Rodder who's out and injured and injury-plagued. You think of Lukan Salakai Loto, and apart from that, you're going, oh, geez, he's scratching the surface like Nick Frost, but Frosty's not a guy who's going to dent the gain line too often. So I think there needs to be some more back row running back rowers who get across the gain line, get quick ball, and then you play a Lukan in the second row. Tommy Hooper's not a second rower at the moment, certainly not at test level. He's just not big enough yet. You'll develop into that body. Ned Hannigan's another guy we haven't mentioned just yet, and he's produced a couple of good showings off for the Tars thus far. But yeah, some options of things of different directions for Joe Schmidt to go down. And I just think that you think of Owen Finnegan and you think of Todd Ikefu, there's a little bit of that Wilson Valentini kind of areas where they could, that direction they could go down if they wanted to.
Yeah, I was thinking today that that Wilson Kefu combination is probably a lot like the Reds have got now in McWright and, and Wilson again. Of course, not David Wilson's two young blokes who play for the Waratahs. So I hope you're all keeping up with that one. Mate, yes. Just before we put a bow on that game, the late tackle on Tom Liner, Samopeni Finau, fortunate to avoid a yellow or perhaps something even stronger?
Oh, definitely fortunate. There's no chance it's a red because he hasn't made high contact and he didn't get tipped over the horizontal. So, but given how late it was, the yellow for me, I was discussing over text with Matt Tamua and he was thinking it's a bloody good shot, isn't it? It is a good shot, but it is too late. And that's why I think it should have been a yellow. He had time to pull out of that. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think your yellow there, it's, I mean, it always looks worse in slow motion. We know that, but there was certainly enough time for him to pull out, but he locked his, he had it exactly in his mind what he wanted to do, and that was to lay out young Tom Liner, and that's what he did. Harry McLaughlin Phillips obviously came on late in that game, late on that try with that grubber, didn't he, with that fortunate bounce, but you got to take those, and that's going to be the difference for the Reds, taking those opportunities that do fall in their lap this year to beat teams like the Chiefs. And if we parlay that into the Waratahs, who had a big opportunity to beat the Highlanders, and what was a real arm wrestle of a game. Now, I was out there for the first time as a supporter. I sat in the stands for, I reckon, the first time in about 10 years. Sat behind the posts, which, as you know, is kind of different for us. We're always on the side. So it opened up a whole new perspective for me of watching defensive alignments and just shape of attack as well from behind north-south rather than east-west. So you really hope this isn't one that the Waratahs are going to come back and kick themselves about. You feel for Tane Edmed, but that's rugby. I mean, the rugby gods giveth and they taketh away. Last week, the star of the show against the Crusaders and has the chance to be again this week and pushes a penalty wide and on a night where he didn't have his kicking boots on.
He didn't. He missed one or two earlier, and that's one where Darren Coleman, we spoke at in the press conference shortly after, and the cameras had been switched off, and you're just having a quick word with him to go, yeah, that's an annoying game. I didn't use that sort of language, but he said, look, if you go to the pointy end of the season, you generally win 7 out of those 10 if you're going to get there. And if you don't, you end up getting 3 or 4. And that's the one that you're right. They don't want to be in that 3 or 4 basket. They need to win those games more often than not. And it's a huge missed opportunity. And all game, they were a little bit slow out of the gate. I think Damien Murphy was a little bit trigger happy. It frustrated me, the lack of a tug, the lack of the pulling of the ball when it's on the surface. I don't think you can just have your hands on the ball. You've actually got to pull it up, tug it up,
yep,
and lift it. And it just wasn't occurring more often than not. Max Jorgensen looked like he was going to break away 2 or 3 times, and just the bootlaces that he gets pulled down behind. And he got there in the end, scoring a try, only just, I might add. But yeah. Even the penalty there right at the end, Sam, I'm not sure if you've noticed or you saw afterwards, and it's one of those coulda, woulda, shouldas, but there's no way that penalty where the advantage was, and it wasn't really even an advantage before he pulled it up. It was a couple of phases later, but where Tane Edmund ends up taking the kick there, which is closer towards the 10-metre line and further out towards the 5-metre line, the penalty was given away much closer to the post. It would have been at least 2 or 3 metres infield and a couple of metres further forward. And when you've got a 40-metre pressure cooker as opposed to a 35-metre one more directly in front, that's a huge thing that they've stuffed up there, the officials, and probably even the Waratahs, by not even saying, hey, that penalty was closer infield. So, yeah, it's a huge blow. And the Highlanders are going to test the Brumbies this week because they've really come out of the blocks pretty well. They don't have the injuries like they did this time last year. Jamie Joyce has clearly added a fair bit to this Highlanders side too. And Reece Patchell has been the find of Super Rugby, I'd have to say.
Yeah, hard to disagree with that. The Welshman who came down over the off season obviously had Freddie Burns last year, who didn't really assert himself too much, if at all, on the competition. And I must admit, you know, I didn't read too much into their preseason form, which was strong. They had beaten up the Crusaders, but we're starting fast to learn that, or fast learning that you know, it could be par for the course this year. Yeah, they're looking. The thing that really impressed me about the Highlanders was their defensive shape. And I thought in the first half, as again I go back to watching from behind the sticks for the first time in a long, long while, was the Waratahs' attack seemed very busy. There were a lot of moving parts to it, a lot of decoy runners playing a lot out the back, a lot of players in motion, and it almost felt like it was overly complicated. I think they simplified it after halftime a touch, but the Highlanders defended really well. They just held their shape, and then waited for that opportunity to get on the ball. And as you said, Damon Murphy was fairly trigger happy in that area of the game. So I got to give a full wrap. I said to my brother early on, I said, this has just got the feeling of a penalty after the siren to it. This game, it was tit for tat. The Highlanders obviously scoring through their big outside centre, I think he was. Is it Talia? Anyway, yeah. When he bumped off the two...
Tristan Riley and Joey Walton out wide, yeah.
Both went high and both got bumped off. And, I mean, as you said, the Waratahs hit straight back through Jorgensen, through that nice break from Riley. But that was really the only poor defensive read I thought of the Highlanders in the whole game. They're going to be a top eight side, you would think, for sure. It's a big win on the road for them. And so far, you know, beating an impressive minor Pacifica side first up and then really sticking it to the Blues for sort of 45, 50 minutes as well. They're going to be tough to beat.
What I'll say as well, Langy Gleeson has it. If he brings his hands and he hasn't had them for the last couple of weeks, the Waratahs lead, and I think lead comfortably in the first half. There was two or three moments there that, and one or two deep in the Highlanders' half, there was line break, and then I think it's like one or two phases later, he drops it going to ground in contact, and it's those little coach killers that you go, if you hold the ball and you get a quick recycle, you score next phase, and unfortunately for Langy Gleeson, that hasn't occurred. It didn't come back to the bottom against the Crusaders. It very much tears against the Highlanders.
Yeah, you can see it's frustrating him too, right? I think It was maybe the one in the second half there where he almost looked at them and a bit like old Hot Hands in the Little Giants movie. If you've seen it, come on, fellas, this is the big one. Looking at his hands, shaking his head, they're letting him down badly. I don't know whether it's a reflex snatching at the ball kind of thing, or he's just, you know, a bit hard, to use a cricketing terminology. I don't know what your thoughts are, mate, on that.
I tend to agree that he's a pretty anxious bloke from my understanding. He's a lovely guy, really lovely bloke. He is an anxious bloke too. And we're seeing that come out and displayed on the footy field, because you look at him in terms of his explosiveness and contact, and he runs the ball harder than pretty much anyone in Australian rugby from the forward pack. So, and he breaks the line so regularly for that very reason. He's just got to tuck it under his wings a bit more ball security, and I'm sure he'll be working on it, but that's important, because it denied the Waratahs a second straight win against New Zealand opposition for the first time since 2015, and that is a long time when you can't get back-to-back wins against Kiwi opposition.
Big time. Just over 13,000, mate, I think, there on Friday night. If you're a Waratahs fan, are you coming back this week for the Blues? Did you see enough to think, yeah, this team, there's something there? Sure, they didn't win tonight. They had a kick clearly to do just that after the siren. And, you know, you're thinking, if you are a supporter out there and they do kick that, then absolutely, yeah, sign me up with the Blues coming next week. Do you think that they can maybe draw, say, 15 next week? And if we just jump back to the Reds, they had 17,000 there when their next home game is in a couple of weeks, or two or three weeks, I think, against the Brumbies. Do you see them pulling maybe 20 plus? I think both cities, there's people there who want to support these teams, clearly. They've just got to give them the reason to do so.
Yeah, the disappointing thing is that the Waratahs, those fans might return this weekend, and you hope that they do. I don't think they draw a much bigger crowd, maybe a slightly bigger. The Highlanders on the road, they're not going to ever draw too many, but the Blues, there'd be more people from Auckland on this side of the ditch. So hopefully they do get an extra 1,000 or two. But if you then slip up again, then you lose the fans. So you need to, consistency is the big one, and just taking your opportunities. And they know that they've missed that opportunity, because if the Tars, you know, that last gasp win, you know, Tane Edmonds slots the goal, and then you stumble against the Blues, the fans are willing to give you that second chance. But if they go down and go down badly against the Blues, who will be fired up after going down to the Hurricanes themselves, then it makes it all the more difficult to be able to encourage those fans back again.
Yeah, Blues are a big physical team too, so they'll need to rise for that challenge. Saturday afternoon earlier, mate, the Brumbies and the Force. Look, fair play to the Force. They'll probably be kicking themselves, I think, as much as the Waratahs might be. They were in this one up to their eyeballs. And just a couple of key moments. Harry Potter's yellow card for that aerial challenge off the kickoff early in the second half. A couple of spilt balls at inopportune times. You know, throughout parts of this period of this match, you kind of almost felt that they were the better team against a Brumbies team that, as I said, you know, first week, yeah, they were good enough against the Rebels team, just sweated on their mistakes and struck with the ruthlessness that we've come to expect from them. Last week, just diabolical and didn't meet the physical challenge at all. And you know, might be somewhat fortunate to have escaped with the 4 points on Saturday in this one.
They were very fortunate. And the other turning point in that game occurred midway through the first half when Ryan Coxon takes out Darcy Swain with a bit of a decoy run. It goes wrong, and Ben Donaldson managed to get an offload away, and the Force should have been up. They should have been up 3-1, and then it's a massive swing, because then the Brumbies go down. They slot another 3 points themselves, and all of a sudden, a big, healthy lead becomes a very narrow one at halftime. And then you compound that with the Harry Potter mistake, which comes just a couple of weeks after he was yellow carded for a similar collision in the air against the Hurricanes. It's a coach killer. And you could see and hear the frustration on Simon Cron's face, and rightly so, because I think they outplayed the Brumbies for most of that game, and yeah, it's a huge blown chance. And even right at the end there, Harry Potter obviously gets knocked out or cops a really nasty
knee,
blow
yep.
there. Yeah, with the knee from the covering defence, and it certainly wasn't malicious or anything, and it deserved not to be penalised, which it wasn't. But that's another opportunity there. They're on the counter attack, and they probably should have stolen that game right at the end. So spare football for the Force fans. They've got Moana Pacifica this week, and that's probably going to be their best opportunity to get a win on the scoreboard, and they desperately need it after three defeats and two of them where they should have probably won.
Early days, admittedly, but do you think the move to the West has been good for Ben Donaldson?
Yeah, absolutely. Good for Donaldson, good for Tane Edmund, because both of them know that they're the tens of their respective franchises. They're not playing out a position potentially. Like Max Bury is probably the one feeling like, would be great to get my hands on the ball more. Yeah. And similarly, Isaac Faisaloluwasa is probably thinking, I want to get more game time too, because I think Super Rugby coaches on the whole in Australia have the tendency to keep their star players or their perceived star players out for too long. We've seen that with Jake Gordon on the weekend. Teddy Wilson comes on immediately and makes an impact. He's got a great pass, does Teddy Wilson. And we saw that the extra speed, the extra time that it gives his playmaker on the outside by getting quick ball to the backline is a really pivotal thing. And you compare that to what the Highlanders were previously doing with Talau Fakatawa and Aaron Smith. At the Highlanders, Fakatawa, even though he was second fiddle to Aaron Smith for much of the time, he was still regularly getting 25 minutes.
Yeah,
players in Australia can't afford to just get 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, because it slows the development, it exposes your depth, and it actually encourages players to not just leave their franchises but leave Australian rugby. So it's a really big warning, I think, that for Australia's coaches, that they can't leave their players on the bench. And we saw that even with the Waratahs with Mahe Vaiolano. You know, it's a tough thing for a hooker to be playing plus 70 minutes, and Mahe's had to do that 2 weeks in a row.
Just before we leave the Force, you agree that there's been progression there week to week this year? Fairly, well, just very ordinary first up against the Hurricanes. Better against the Rebels for sort of 45, 50 minutes and then let that one slip away completely. Again, this is a third straight defeat, but as we said, probably one that they'll absolutely be kicking themselves about. Is Simon Cron right to be optimistic about where they're heading?
Optimistic, but livid that they haven't taken their chances. And that probably shows the shortcomings and the frailties in Australian rugby, the inability to close out games or take chances. We saw that with the Reds on the weekend. We didn't see that with the Tars. We didn't see that with the Force. We haven't seen that with the Force 2 weeks in a row. Yeah, Cronny will be able to go, there's some good things we're doing, but that ability to win and overcome the mental barriers there, that's a big thing that they've now got to start to resurrect and overcome. But on that note, shout out to the Rebels who were able to do that with a really strong last 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, they did. Andrew Kellaway, a couple of nice finishes in the first half there, wasn't there? Just can slot seamlessly from fullback to the wing and vice versa. Scrum obviously was very strong for them again. Tupu coming off the bench and making a big impact there. And as you were mentioning before we came on air, it sets up a massive game in Melbourne on Friday night. Now, if anyone out there in Melbourne, beyond the absolute Rebels diehards who we know and respect and I love you for keep turning up, is to get along to this one because, you know, as you mentioned, there's a heck of a lot of Queenslanders throughout this Rebels team. It's not just Tupu, it's Salakai Loto and Alex Murphy and others around the place. And, you know, this is a game that they will feel that they can win. And what a time to get one over the Reds, who've just knocked off the competition favourites, the red-hot favourites, with one of the best performances in their recent history, as we said. So a massive opportunity for both these sides. And you kind of feel that, you know, this is it could be a splitting point for their two seasons, right? Whoever wins this could really kick on and go on and be a top four side. And for the loser, it might all fall apart. Maybe more so for the Rebels in that regard. I think the Reds can potentially bounce back. But this is a game that, you know, I'm really looking forward to.
Absolutely. And you consider it, and you're right to make that point, because if you compare it to last year, the Reds won 5 games, the Rebels won 4 games. And if you go 3 from 4 first up, that just sets up your season really, really nicely. And yeah, the other name though, Felipe Dungudu, another guy that was at the Reds just recently, Carter Gordon, a Queensland guy that was at the Pathways once upon a time, James Tattle, another one. So there's Reds and former Reds littered throughout this Rebels team. And well, I think it's almost the match of the round. I'm really excited about it because there's so much emotion going to be on display in this one. Tupou up against his former franchise is probably the biggest one, but with Super Rugby and with Australian Rugby where it is, the Reds will just desperately want to be able to keep that momentum going into their next home game, which is still a couple of weeks away. I think they take on the Brumbies, but that's a long gap to be able to keep on to those supporters and build momentum. And similarly with the Rebels, they're just desperate to continue to build on their performances. And playing for 60 to 70 minutes as opposed to 40 to 50 would be the big one for the Rebels. I think the Reds, they've shown enough to be able to kick on, but I can see that Rebels type 5 really trying to go after the Reds. And, you know, even Nick Styles previously at the Reds himself. So Nick Sampson, another Queenslander, it's an exciting prospect that starts another really promising weekend of Super Rugby.
Yeah, Reds have actually got the Force the week after at home. So they win this one Friday night and win that one. That'll be 4 out of 5 and probably should have been 5 out of 5 and your season's really humming. So, yeah, really looking forward to that one. Crusaders, mate, are they gone? I don't think anyone will be quite ruling them out of top 8 possibilities at this point in time. But Rob Penny, I think he's got a few issues there.
Oh, mate, they've got the Hurricanes on Friday night to start the competition, or the weekend, round four. They follow that up by having to go up to Eden Park to take on the Blues, and then they take on the Chiefs. Like, it's a seriously tough next 3 weeks for them. I think they win enough to scrape into the Super Rugby finals, and they shouldn't be able to get a couple of players back towards the back end of the season, guys like Cody Taylor, and I think it's...
Blackadder shouldn't be too far.
Blackadder, there's Fergus Burke, I think his name is, the fly half, who we've seen bits and pieces of. So they'll get a few guys back, but wow, they're in a serious world of hurt, and it's a massive, not necessarily fall from grace, because we knew that there was going to be, it was going to be tough to replace some serious legends, but it's a huge come down from what has been the most impressive 7 years in Super Rugby history for them to do what they did under Scott Robinson. There was only really one way down, one way for Rob Penny, and that was probably down, unfortunately, for them. But wow, like that, the Fiji draw, it was a really difficult game to watch, that one, because there was so much drop ball, the humidity was on display, and both teams were really guilty of it. I think it was something like 37 turnovers for the game. It was just scrum after scrum. They've just got to get back to serious basics. And Scott Barrett even said it at the end of full time. He said, we went into this game with a pretty simple game plan. Unfortunately, in that heat and that humidity, the simple game plan didn't work. They've got to just ensure that they do the basics really well over the next couple of weeks.
Big time, big time. All right, mate, a couple of other bits of news doing the rounds. If we start with the most immediate, emerged yesterday that Jordan Bataia, being seriously looked at for an NRL switch, the Dragons, my Dragons, who had a massive win to start. Well done to them. First up, strong links that he could be, was kind of rumoured also, I think about 12 months ago as well, that he could be a player who looking for a change. What do you know about this one? And is he one of the more frustrating players in Australian rugby in recent times? Because I think we all know the immense talent that he's got, and he's shown it any number of times in individual plays here and there. But a lack of consistency has probably meant, and being shifted between positions, no doubt hasn't helped him. I wouldn't be heartbroken if he left, and that's just not me saying it because he would be going to my NRL team. I feel, you know, it may even be good for him, as much as maybe a couple of years away in the UK or Japan, and then come back. I don't know. He's a hard guy to read.
Yeah, and his struggles and his inconsistency has embodied the struggles and encapsulated struggles of not just the Queensland Reds over the last few years, but Australian rugby, because he's up and down like a yo-yo. What he delivers on the field, he's got so much potential, unbelievable raw power and athleticism. It can do things that a lot of the other backs in the Queensland and Australian lineup can't do. But the amount of ball he turns over as well, it shakes your head. You shake your head and you go, how's this guy doing that? And there's a part of me that thinks that if Les Kiss was the Queensland coach 2 years ago, that Jordan Bataia is a completely different player.
And conversely, mate, is he the guy that can maybe convince him to stay around?
Possibly. My understanding is that Jordan Bataia is not in a huge rush to make his decision on what his next step is, and he hasn't been for a while. There's been things bubbling in the surface for quite a while, and for more than a year, there's been interest in the NFL in a similar route to Lewis Rees-Sammet. I know we touched upon it, I think, about a month ago.
Yeah.
With Lewis's switch, and he's giving the NFL a crack, but Lewis can easily just go straight back to rugby. He'll be able to find a spot up in the Northern Hemisphere really easy. And I think similarly, if Bataia was to take that option, he would also be able to find a slot pretty quickly. You find out within a couple of months as to whether or not you're going to be able to make it or not, or get given a more of an opportunity or not. We'll find out, I think, not necessarily next week, but in a month or so around where Bataia's thinking. The other thing that's slowed this is with no David Nusifora really in the Australian Rugby Australia picture, because he still works with Ireland. He's just a consultant at this stage, and he's wearing his Irish cap firmly. With Peter Horn only just recently coming on board last week, with Joe Schmidt only just getting his feet under the desk as well. Player recruitment and retention has been the thing that has kind of been left to fall on the wayside a bit.
Kicked down the road a bit, yep.
Yeah, there's not been any proactiveness, not just with Petaia, but with several players, because they don't actually really know where these guys sit. And in addition to that, with the Melbourne Rebels and the scenario taking place down there, franchises are unsure around when they're going to be able to act on a lot of things and how much money to allocate to particular players too. So there's lots of balls in the air in the court at the moment going, well, where could this fall and drop? And that's the thing with Petaia. How much money is RA prepared to offer a guy that's got bucket loads of potential but hasn't always delivered on it? And so getting back on the field, that concussion obviously wouldn't have helped, but getting on the field and playing consistent rugby, Petaia was doing that for the Reds last year before his injury, which slowed his progress. He had a really, I think, pretty poor international season. If he can get back on the field and show a fair bit, then RA might come back and be able to offer him a little bit. But the other thing left to consider is the Joseph Suaalii deal that's just blown everything away, that other players are a little bit frustrated, thinking, well, if this guy's on 1.6, I'm expecting at least half that. I'm not going to just sit around for 500,000, 400,000, even though his consistency hasn't been there. He could go overseas to Japan for the best part of $1 million, or he could make a code switch. There's lots of things at play here for Jordan Petaia, but I wouldn't say it's a foregone conclusion that he goes to the Dragons.
Okay, yeah, Japan still may well prove the option for me if I'm thinking about it at this point in time. The other big news last week, we finally got confirmation of the Australian Rugby Australia's review into, you know, the Wallabies 2023 season. And obviously the headline was the $2.6 million beyond budget. Now, we knew this was coming. We didn't know the figure. It had been rumoured to be around $5 million. It didn't turn out to be that much, or at least that much in the official report. But it was infuriating to a lot of people. Not surprising, I don't think, but it's a hell of a lot of money to have blown on a team that underperformed spectacularly and clearly had a coach who surrounded himself with yes men. And I think one of the telling moments of that documentary, as we mentioned, potentially the only person to challenge him was the psychologist. I think Corinne Reid was the name at that selection meeting ahead of the Fiji game. And I actually wrote a column about this. I think we spoke about it in France on the pod at the time, that I thought that was the absolutely wrong way to handle that, about delaying that confirmation that Skelton was out. The team was already nervy from following Tupu's injury earlier in the week. But if we bring it back to the 2.6 again, as I said, hardly surprising. But a figure that does not reflect well on Jones, the Wallabies, and particularly Rugby Australia. Diabolical, I guess.
Yeah, we'll talk about those recommendations in a moment, because they put me to sleep when I was reading them. The 2.6 million figure, that's the sort of thing that does stick out in the headline, and it's alarming, but I wasn't surprised. And one of the things is, how much had they really allocated for their budget for the year? I heard, and when did they actually make that budget? And when did they, you know, list how much it was going to cost? Because it may well have been before Eddie Jones arrived. And if that's in December, Dave Rennie's working under one sort of thing, and then clearly a second with Eddie Jones coming in, everything changes. And Phil Wall, Dan Hervert, they can't wipe their hands clean of this one.
Yeah, so has there been enough accountability, mate, I guess is the big question here, because they were both clearly on the board at that time. Phil was, you know, came into that chief executive role at July 1, I think it was, with the new financial year. What about these other people on the board? Clearly, Hamish McLennan is gone, Eddie Jones is gone. Is that enough? I don't want to say blood in the water is probably the wrong term, but is there, you know, have enough people copped a hammering over this that they we think they should have?
Yeah, there's a couple of things to that. I think there has been enough blood that's been spilled. because losing a chairman and a head coach is really significant. I think that the positions have been filled really well, in the sense that Peter Horn, people from very early signs are really impressed by him. In addition, he was very much a significant player in getting Joe Schmidt across the line. So there's been a couple of really good selections there. But it's a mark against Wall and Herbert, because they were part of the high-performance committee that would speak to Eddie Jones on almost a daily basis. And my understanding is Hamish McLennan would ask, he would often speak to Warrie as opposed to Eddie Jones. And he would ask Warrie, has Eddie got everything he needs? And from what I've been told, more often than not, it said, yep, Eddie's really happy, everything's all good. And it's, as CEO, you need to be the one that's got people in roles and positions to ensure that the checks and balances take place. And just because you didn't have someone in a role, like a high-performance manager at the time, that shows the ineptness of Rugby Australia at the time, that they didn't have those checks and balances in place. Because if you go in, then you're paying, like a Chris Webb is paying on the credit card to go, yep, we need to shift hotels for X reason. It's got to go up the food chain. It'll send out an alert, and those, you know, the accountants, the COOs have to be looking at that going, oh, what's going on here? And then questions have to be asked, because my understanding is there was 3 hotel changes throughout the year. France, before the last game of the warm-up match, where yep. they stayed at a lovely hotel in Paris. They changed a hotel in Melbourne. That one was paid for by Sansa. They decided to shift hotels, which means that RA had to pay for that hotel. There was a chartered plane that they had to get from Arnhem Land to pick up the remainder of their baggage, which didn't go with the first one. So things start to get out of hand very rapidly. They were given everything that they wanted, and it failed spectacularly, as you said. And now it looks even worse because they did so. So fortunately, some of those things that weren't in place are now going to be there. I can't imagine that the same slip-ups would occur, but you go through those 23 recommendations, and the thing that says to me is, well, what are you doing with your high-performance system to begin with? Because if some of the things were just so basic that were being spelled out, it just read like corporate jargon that not just put me asleep, but would have put the casual supporter reading this going, how are you the Wallabies, a 2-time World Cup winner, and coming out with this bollocks? It was just boring, and it showed really where Rugby Australia and the Wallabies high-performance system has been for quite a few years if they had to stick to such basic principles.
Yeah, well, I've just brought it up here, mate, in front of me, and it was broken into sort of 5 categories: high-performance strategy, Wallabies and high-performance programs, culture, governance, and the national coaching program. But just to pick one out here, development of a cohesive training and program principles to establish more clarity for players. Wouldn't you want to try and do that for your under sixes side? Like, lay out a program to teach kids, you know, it's, as you say, it's a lot of jargon through it. I guess maybe one that stood out and clearly during that press conference, I know you weren't there because you were travelling back from Queensland, having been to the Super W launch, but Peter Horn was asked about, you know, effectively the leadership stuff, foster greater interaction between RA board and national players to build trust, promote transparency and improve culture. Now, there's definitely something in that because, you know, you and I have had conversations with multiple players off the record, and you can tell how just disgusted's probably the word with how things panned out last year and how disappointed they were with certain aspects throughout the and the leadership, I guess, management in particular. Horn was asked, well, you know, what are we going to do here? What's the biggest issue you feel has come out of last year? And he said, well, we've lost trust. The players don't trust Rugby Australia. They've got no belief really in that. We've got the ability to manage the game and steer the game and be the stewards for the game. So there's something that's got to change there. Clearly, it'll be intriguing to see who, I guess, fronts that Wallabies leadership group this year under Joe Schmidt, whether he goes for, say, a 6-7 strong group that that Eddie did last year. Hopefully doesn't cycle through six captains. I mean, as you say, there was a lot in that that was just like that's an absolute snore fest. And we've been through this process of a review before. We had it at the end of 2018 when Scott Johnson was installed as a director of rugby above Michael Checker, an appointment that Check freely admits he didn't enjoy. He didn't love the three-man selection panel. That also blew up spectacularly when Michael O'Connor had some fairly choice summations of how things were going at Wallabies training throughout that World Cup camp. And I put that to Phil Waugh. I said, mate, what's going to be different about this one? Because we've been down this road before and you look at this and it's just a lot of buzzwords on a piece of paper. And it said, well, we've got to execute on it. And then that comes back to that accountability part of it, doesn't it? Again, that who's, is Peter Horn going to be the man that looks as, can, you know, continually checking back to what that, to those 23 recommendations, checking in with the players, checking in with the coaches. Are we meeting these outcomes? How can we do better so that we can meet these outcomes? And, you know, everyone will be keenly watching. I don't think anyone will have any great expectations, you know, that this is going to be fulfilled. But clearly there needs to be a new direction. You've mentioned Peter Horn's in the job, Joe Schmidt's in the job. So there has been some good that's come out of last year's horror show. But now it's about executing on those positions and this piece of paper as well.
Yeah, indeed. I think last year brought to a head so many of the issues in Australian rugby, and it also showed the lack of vision that Rugby Australia has had for some time. And that's still something that I don't think has been clearly laid out around where does Rugby Australia and the Wallabies want to go? Because at the same time that there's been added layers in the Australian rugby ecosystem, and namely women's rugby with Super W and an added and important emphasis on the Wallaroos too, there's been shit fight and shit show after the other. And you go from 2017 with the Rebels and the Force debacle leading to the Force being out, the Israel Folau debacle in 2018 and 2019, the Michael Checker and Ray Lane debacle of 2019, then the COVID, obviously pandemic, but the ousting of Ray Lane Castle as CEO in 2020, a brand new, there was an interim CEO followed by a new CEO, the ousting of Dave Rennie into the ousting of Andy Marinos. There's been way too much change and no continuity, and that has meant, in addition to all of that as well, the NRC that's come and gone, there's been too much change, and there needs to be some stability, some vision around where the game needs to go to, and those sorts of things, when you put them all together, that's where you lose confidence in the Rugby Australia board. It's not isolated into Eddie Jones and that decision alone, which obviously did not work out. It's a culmination of so many things. And someone like a James Slipper, who's been playing for longer than you and I, both probably been journalists.
Yep.
You know, he's been playing for 15 years at the top. He's seen and witnessed all of this car crash unfold. And that's the challenge to Rugby Australia, is to get your ducks in a row and to assure that there's some stability, because the punters and the players alike are fed up with it.
Yep. I don't think I could have said it any better, mate. And there are green shoots at the moment. As I mentioned, a couple of my mates talking around that they've enjoyed watching Super Rugby Pacific so far. So people, you know, it's not, it's clearly not in good shape, but there's people out there who, you know, are rugby people who want to believe in the team. The team's plural, be them all, those who wear green and gold for Australia and see success in five Super Rugby teams, or if that comes back to four. In the future, those two. So, yes, we'll watch this space on those 23 recommendations and just see if they meaningful change can be implemented both at board level and on and off the field and around the game. Cool, mate. All right. I think that's a pretty good wrap for the week. You have a good one. What's on your agenda?
Well, I was just going to say, so shout out, Super W does kick off this weekend.
Yep.
And
Super Rugby Women's, it's had a...
Yes, it has indeed. Super Rugby Women's, I'm not quite sure if it flows off. It's probably a nightmare for those getting in the headline. But But it does open with a really good game between the Fijiana draw up against the Reds. It's a replay of last year's finals. So be sure to tune in for that. Lots of emotion, particularly for a Reds side that I think blew their fourth grand final and that they lost. So they want to definitely atone for that one. So yeah, keep an eye on that. Six Nations was a beauty over the weekend. Lots to catch up on. Heaps of rugby. It's a good time of year.
Yeah, Louis Leiner. What a try for Italy there. Two big upsets up there. It's actually a weekend of upsets around the game. Geez, the Welsh, they might be in a dire strait as Australia at the moment. I saw Warren Gatland, a clip on social media, might have aborted an interview with the BBC fairly abruptly. Got Jacka waiting, and things aren't good in the valleys. Right, mate. One more.
I was just going to say last one, and the Queensland Reds, just on that, on Wales. Queensland Reds are going to host Wales in a tour game. I think it's awesome to see the Welsh. Clearly, it's a rebuilding mission for them under Warren Gatland, trying to get as many games together. But that's awesome. I think it's July 19 at Suncorp Stadium. There won't be the internationals involved because Australia will be playing Georgia shortly after, but that's a great thing for player development, but also an opportunity for Queensland to play their first international side since, I think, the Lions in 2013, but Scotland in 2004 when they thumped them then. So, yeah, good run for Queensland rugby.
Yeah, well done to everyone up there at Ballymore, and there's certainly good things happening up in Queensland. All right, team, that'll do us for a week. I'll see you in 7 days, and enjoy the footy in the meantime. Cheers.